This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Born into post-apartheid South Africa, the young women of the townships around Cape Town still face many daunting challenges. Yet, as Kimberly Burge discovered when she set up a writing group in the township of Guguletu, the spirit of these girls outshines their circumstances. Kimberly Burge joins us to discuss her experiences and the stories of these young women, which she shares in her book, The Born Frees, Writing with the Girls of Guguletu. Later in the show, we'll hear how these experiences are being used to help women locally. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Kimberly, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Good to see you.
Thank you so much, Mark. I'm really excited to be here.
And you live in Washington, D.C., but you're originally from Cincinnati, right?
I am. I grew up in Blue Ash, graduated from Sycamore High School, and have been out in D.C. about 20 years now, but I still love coming home. I still claim Graders and La Rosa's and all my favorite places and tell people about Cincinnati, and it's a wonderful city.
Well, welcome back to Cincinnati,
Thank
Kimberly.
You.
So start us off by telling us, who are the Born Frees?
So the Born Frees, that's what South Africans call this first generation growing up after the end of apartheid. They're children that were born sort of between 1990, when Nelson Mandela walked free from prison, when he was released from prison, and 1994, when he was elected the first Black South African president. And as I'm sure your listeners know, apartheid, that was the government-sanctioned system of racial segregation that existed for so many years in South Africa that ended in 1994 officially. And so these young women are coming of age now. They're in their early 20s, late teens, and they're inheriting their freedoms. They're inheriting a free country. They don't have the same restrictions that their parents and grandparents had based on their skin colors. But they're also inheriting a country that has a tremendous amount of problems along with its promise.
Yeah, so they aren't living under the racial discrimination of apartheid anymore. But what hardships and what challenges are they facing, Kimberly?
So South Africa now has one of the highest levels of income inequality in the world. It's a huge gap between the rich and the poor. And some people call it economic apartheid, that's what's kind of overtaken the place. There's also tremendous levels of violence against women and girls, sexual violence, high levels of rape, and then violence in the townships. The Black townships, that's where people of color were forced to live during apartheid. And, you know, but they grew up into communities, and so a lot of people still choose to live there because that's their homes. But there's high levels of unemployment. I think the youth unemployment between 15 and 24 is higher than 50%. So in some instances, these young people, they have a hard time seeing where the promise is, you know, that they've inherited in a free country.
So what kinds of efforts are underway to deal with all these issues?
Well, I mean, they are playing catch up. I mean, we think of the way that we still struggle with issues of racism in our country. And it's been, you know, so many hundreds of years, you know, 150 years since the end of slavery. But and it hasn't been that long. It's only been 21 years since apartheid ended. But I think what gives me hope is they are the promise that they bring themselves, that they have tremendous insights into ways that their country has built them up and strengthened them and the ways that it's let them down. And, you know, they're trying to increase the amount given for schools and such. But at the same time, 80% of public schools in South Africa don't have libraries. So these girls are really struggling to find ways to be educated kind of in the official ways if they can't find the fees to go to attend better schools.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation with Kimberly Burge. And let's talk with Howard. He is outside Washington, D.C. Hi, Howard.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. Kimberly, how are you? This is a fascinating subject, and I just want to congratulate you on your work. And I'm just curious, are you fortified with enough Diet Coke in Greater Washington?
Well, thank you. I'm doing good. Thanks. It's really, I forget how wonderful people are in the Midwest sometimes. It's so great to be back in Ohio. Thank you, Howard.
Howard, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. 513.
Take care, KDB.
Okay. That's old a friend. It is an old friend. It's actually a former coworker who helped me learn. Actually, he helped me get to Africa for the first time. I'll tell a Howard story. In 2002, my first, I was working in a nonprofit job in DC, and working on issues of global poverty. And that was my first visit to South Africa, was in 2002. I went with some colleagues and visited. We were in Malawi and Mozambique and South Africa and Cape Verde. It was a whirlwind of a 3-week trip. And, you know, my interest in South Africa goes back to the 80s. I'm old enough to remember that. and it had an effect on me as an activist learning about this country. And I celebrated when Mandela walked out of prison and such. And I always wanted to go there. And so I had the opportunity. And especially being in Cape Town, I realized I need to get back here because it's not a place you can understand in a few days. It's not a place I understood after a year. I think anything, it just gave me more questions to want to explore. But at the same time, the people were so welcoming. And, you know, I really thought that I would be, that people would be standoffish because I was white, honestly, and an outsider. And, you know, I'm very aware of that. And I was embraced so warmly that it just has become my second home.
Well, how did you come to work with this particular group of young women?
So in Google A2, which you did an excellent job of saying, some people have a hard time with it, but yeah, I was based at a church and community center called J.L. Zwani, Presbyterian Church, and they had been active for a very long time, during apartheid, kind of, you know, trying to bring about the end of apartheid. But then after that, they were one of the first faith-based, organizations, faith-based communities to address the AIDS crisis. And so they really made a point to try to break down the stigma that, you know, because that was basically when apartheid ended, then the AIDS pandemic, that was kind of hit right away, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, so they have been very active in this community. And I, a colleague at a organization I was working at put me in touch. He had worked there, for several years and put me in touch with J.L. Zwani. And the pastor was very welcoming and said, you know, I would love to have you here. And I was, at that time, I was applying for a Fulbright fellowship. I went over as a Fulbright scholar and wanted to, as I said, I wanted to spend time in Cape Town very selfishly because it's beautiful. But I also wanted to work with these young women and wanted to hear them talk about their lives and their communities and their country and what they thought of it and to hear it through their own words. I wanted to write about them, but I wanted the book. I wanted to make sure that the book incorporated much of their own writing, which is what it does, their poetry and prose. They're tremendous poets, some of these young women, and that before I ever landed, I mean, that had nothing to do with me. They just had this real thirst for language, I think.
Right. You weren't setting out to teach them how to write. You weren't setting out to teach grammar, punctuation, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. This was
not at all. No. And I made a point when I got up in the church the first Sunday morning to announce that we were going to have this writing club. I made sure to call it a club because who wants to go to a class on Saturday afternoons? You're not going to.
Exactly.
That's a hard sell with teenage girls, you know? So I said, yes, exactly. I'm not teaching grammar. This isn't about the commas. It's about finding your voice and finding out what you have to say and claiming that. And I had no idea what to expect. And the first week I did it, the first Saturday, there were 22 girls that showed up, which was a lot.
Is that pretty much typical that you'd have around 20 show up for the class?
No.
The club, I should say.
I could have anywhere, Mark, from 4 to 22 week to week. And that you just didn't know. But I had about 10 that became my kind of stalwarts that were there each week. And those are, six of the girls are the ones that I profile in The Born Frees. And, I mean, the book covers the whole year that we spent together. And what was great was many of these girls didn't know each other. And to watch their friendships develop was really fantastic, too. And to see them encourage each other and to see how. So the first week that we got together, we brainstormed for a name, and the girls, they named it Amazwe Intombi, which in Xhosa means voices of the girls. And that's Xhosa is their first language. That's the one with the clicks. That's the only click I can do. But it's like you're calling a horse. Like,
so they came up with a name for the group, though.
They did. Yeah. Okay. Voices of the girls. And I loved it. And I loved how Amazwe, it sounds like amazing. And, that's how I think of them. And so, and I asked them, we spent the format, I would give them a writing prompt. So a kind of a question about their lives or a little bit of poetry or song lyrics or something. And then we would spend some time writing. We started out at 3 minutes so I wouldn't scare them and worked up to 20. And that was never enough. And then when I first started, I had everybody, I asked for girls to volunteer. And after a couple of weeks, Sharon, who is actually, she was the oldest girl in the book. She's the one who's pictured on the cover of the book. She said, no, we're not doing this. Everybody's going to read. We have to be able to trust each other. So no more volunteering. Everybody reads.
Wow.
I said, okay, we're going to listen to Sharon.
That's not an easy thing to do.
No, exactly. But I felt like she, I think that showed that she trusted, like she respected the other girls enough to say, you're brave enough. You can do this. Don't be scared. Stop being scaredy cats. That was actually the word she used. And to, that meant more coming from her than it did from me, I think, you know. And yeah, she became one of the leaders of the club. And she's fantastic.
So did you find the girls were pretty receptive to the club overall?
Yeah, they really were. And you know, part of it, there aren't enough sort of organized activities, I think, in the township. So, you know, some came because they were bored and didn't have anything else to do, you know, just kind of wandering. But some really were eager to claim their voices. One of the girls that I got to know best, Anna Swaina, I met her actually before the club started. She was one of the very first girls I met when I got to South Africa. And, you know, she's very forward and she asked, what are you doing here? And I told her, I said, you know, I'm starting this writing club for teenage girls. I hope you'll come. And she's probably
writing club for teenage girls.
I know. I didn't know how it would go over. And she's about 4'10" and she stood up real tall and she said, well, I'll be there. I'm a poet. I said, okay, well, I'm glad because I'm not a poet. So I need poets there. And she was. She showed me before we even got together, she brought in her notebook that she had been writing poetry on her own and wanted to share with me. And, you know, and she sort of blew it off. Oh, it's just what I do because I have to get these voices out of my head. And I understand that. That's one of the reasons I write, is to get the voices out of my head, you know. And there's a universal need for that, to kind of make sense of your life. And some of us try to do that through writing.
Were some of the girls dealing with things like depression and anxiety through all this?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Anna Swaina was one who had, she lost her mom when she was 10. Her mother was actually a famous singer.
That's quite a common problem, isn't it? It's losing your parents
it
early.
It is. Yeah. About, I want to say a third of the population, of the youth population, have been orphaned because of AIDS, because of violence and poverty and the accompanying struggles with that. But another girl, Ntombi, who was the holdout on reading. She was closer in age to Sharon. She was 18. And Ntombi has this real kind of gravelly voice, and she hates the sound of her voice, and she didn't want to read out loud. And finally, Sharon kind of pushed her, and she did. And she, you could just sort of see the light come on in her eyes. And come to find out, as I got to know Ntombi, her mother had died when she was 14. She moved in with her aunts who were raising her, but they were struggling. They had inherited 4 children, Ntombi and her siblings, to raise. And so they were taking care of their material needs, but they didn't have the resources to parent. And so this girl was basically struggling with the loss of her mother. She'd lost her father as well, and she was having a hard time in school, and she was on her own, basically getting her way through this. And she was terribly depressed when I met her. And, you know, she used to check books out of the library. She would go into town in a taxi, a kind of shared, it's like a VW minibus, the shared taxis that people will take into town. And she'd go to the library and she'd get out 6 books, the maximum number she was allowed, and she'd go back home and go to bed. And because she'd finished school, but she hadn't been able to pass. They have these matric exams that they have to pass in order to get their high school diploma. And she had done really well in some, and then she had failed math and science. And so she couldn't get her degree, and she really wanted to go on and do future study. And so, but she wasn't a club person. She told me she really didn't want to be in the writing club. She's not one to join this. And I said, well, just come see what you think. And she was another one that she just opened up. And, you know, and part of that was the response of the other girls, because we ended up, the way it happened, we would end up talking about, you know, one girl would read and somebody else would just talk about, well, this makes me think of this and such. And so it became It wasn't therapy because I'm not qualified to do that, but it was just a place where they could be heard and they would, you know, they could come and would be listened to and not challenged or judged or said, you have no right to say this. And it was great to see what that meant to Ntombi.
We will continue our conversation with Kimberly Burge, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. My guest this afternoon, Kimberly Burge, author of The Born Free's Riding with the Girls of Gugulethu. And you can join the conversation, 513-419-7100. Email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Kimberly, is this something you would ever do again, go back and set up a writing club like this all over again?
Oh, my goodness. Other people have asked me that. You know, and there are ways in America that I think this is needed. And actually, we'll be talking about that in the second half of the show, I think. Yeah, I would love to. I mean, it was difficult to, I discovered this is my first book. It was difficult to write a book about a place so far away from my home. And, you know, after my year was up, when I was living there, it wasn't easy to, you know, I can't run there for a weekend when I had questions and such. But I do think that the power of writing is something that can be harnessed in so many different ways. And there are some amazing organizations throughout America. I wish one of my biggest regrets, I guess, is that I wish I had set up an infrastructure that could have continued the club after I left. I wish I would have worked more closely with some South Africans to keep that going, because the girls now, when I have gone back to see them and catch up and finish research for the book, they're scattered. You know, their lives have gone in, you know, different directions, and some are still writing, some aren't. Some, they're doing a lot more on their phones. They'll just like type things up on their phones or on Facebook, but then they'll erase it, Sharon was saying. And I said, don't do that. You know, what you have, those journals, when I had their journals from 2010, you know, and we had a reunion and they read them, and it's this moment of their lives. And again, the life of their country. You know, one of the cool things, I was there, because I was there in 2010, it was World Cup year. So that was when the Soccer World Cup happened in South Africa, and it was the first time on the African continent. And that is a huge deal. It's like the Super Bowl on steroids to the world, yes. You know, and it gave South Africa the chance to put themselves forward to the world and to see how that affected and how it brought people together. I mean, because soccer was always traditionally a black sport, that whites followed rugby, which those championships have just been happening as well. But to see, again, everybody rally around and really get excited and support the country was a really exciting time.
Were you amazed by the growth that you saw in these young women?
I was, yeah. And I think that it was things that it just tapped into. I think what the club did was tap into things that were already present within them, but they didn't have anybody to encourage that or to kind of to stoke that. And, you know, several of them are at university now. They've are finishing up at university because it's, you know, it's been going on 5 years since the end of our time, which is like a lifetime to them because, you know, at that age. yeah. But, and again, Ntombi, the one I was talking about earlier, you know, she still struggled to pass those science and math exams. But what she did, she found a school where she could go, she could attend because she had completed the coursework. And so she could go into a business program. So she did that. And then she found another school to continue. It helps traditionally disadvantaged students, you know, coming from townships and such. And the idea, there's no cost to attend, but you pay it forward. So you have to put so much into your community, back into your community. And it's the perfect sort of thing for Ntombi. And that's what she's doing now. And again, this was a girl who literally couldn't get out of bed, you know, was reading the Twilight series for the third time, you know, because she just, that was all she could see, you know, through the depression. And she's really, she's fantastic.
Well, right? It kind of ties in with one of the chapters in your book, though, that the chapter title is Make the Choice to Live and not just exist. And I think maybe is that the big message that, that people should take away from this book?
I hope so. Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, you know, nobody thinks that they'll lose their mother when they're 14 or 10. Nobody thinks that they'll, I mean, because several of the girls are HIV positive themselves. Mm. You know, young women have the highest rates of HIV infection between 15 and 24. And, you know, you don't think you're going to get the stigmatizing disease that you have to take medication for, but that happens. And you do have to make a choice about whether or not to live the life that you're given. And I'm really proud of the girl that these girls have chosen to do that, even despite the struggles and such that they're facing.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join the conversation, let's talk with Eric in Over the Rhine. Hi, Eric.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thank you.
Hey, Kim. Just have a quick question for you. I think, you know, a lot of times we talk about the persistence of inequality and violence in post-colonial countries as though it's just a sort of natural feature of life, like the weather or something. And I was wondering if you could help me understand how these sort of white elite minority held on to power and blocked a kind of more radical redistribution of power and wealth that I think many were calling for prior to the end of apartheid.
How they held on to power?
Well, how they were able to block basically a meaningful redistribution of, you know, political power and resources.
Is this summing it up right, Erica? Why does inequality continue even though apartheid has been done away with? Is that
who are the active forces and, you know, in maintaining that?
Oh, sure. That's probably a really complicated question, especially around South Africa.
Like you were saying the whole the circumstances and situation are complicated.
Sure,
too, so.
Yeah, and I mean, I always say, you know, I claim I'm not at all a historian or an Africanist and such. I mean, I think that there's greed. I think in some ways that's just kind of a human nature. You know, there's been a redistribution in some ways. I mean, there are certainly more blacks who have great wealth, but the discrepancy is greater now than even during apartheid. So the people, the elites aren't looking out for people in need as much as they perhaps should be. I don't think that's an issue that is specific to South Africa or to post-colonial countries. I think that's an issue we struggle with here. I mean, I know there's a lot of news out this week. There's a big report coming out about homelessness in Cincinnati and how homeless families are affected. You know, so this is something that there's inequality. Our country is has the largest level of inequality in developed countries around the world. And so I think we just aren't doing a great job of taking care of one another. I think, Eric, is maybe what it comes down to.
Coming up, we will hear how these experiences and the spirit of these young women in South Africa are being used to support women locally. Thanks to Roberta Johnson for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7.